It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This week, the National Center for Education Statistics released what's known as the nation's report card. On national reading and math exams, the scores of Wisconsin 4th and 8th graders remain mostly unchanged since 2022, and our state performed better than most others in both subjects. But according to the data, Wisconsin continues to have the biggest test score gap between black and white students in the country. And Milwaukee Public Schools has among the lowest scores for reading and math out of the 26 urban districts surveyed. We turn to a member of the State Senate's Committee on Education to talk further about the takeaways from the 2024 National Assessment of Educational Progress. Democratic State Senator Chris Larson is here, represents a district in southeast Milwaukee County. State Senator Larson, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me, Kate. Good to be here. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. What are your top line takeaways here? What stands out?
I think these are distressing scores for sure. But I think we have to start with two baselines before we dive in and try to figure out what to make of it and where we go from here. And the first thing is there's no test results that can come back from NAEP where we get to give up on our kids. And I think the second one is to recognize that in these NAEP scores, as well as a lot of the assessments that happen, there is a strong negative correlation with poverty, meaning the higher the poverty, the lower the test scores. So I think starting from those two points, I think we can have an honest conversation about what we all can do to try and make sure we're addressing the underlying poverty, and then also making sure we're boosting these test scores to a place where we can all be comfortable and our kids have a clear path towards getting towards the American dream.
We should note, too, that there is a bright spot here. Eighth grade math scores are the third highest in the nation. What do you think is working in math that is not working in reading?
Yeah, I mean, we've definitely got to dive a little bit deeper into the data to figure out what that is going to show us. But I think that there has been a lot of growth on the literacy side, too. So, yes, we're doing better in math for eighth grade, which is fantastic. But there's also been growth over time within the school district, which one of the school board members had pointed out. But you have to dive in and focus on this stuff to be able to understand that there is some brighter spots like the one that you pointed out.
Wisconsin continues to have the widest test score gap between black and white students. What is the legislature doing on this piece to close this racial disparity gap?
Yeah, there has been a continued disinvestment in Milwaukee. We unfortunately have one of the most segregated communities in the country. If you are underfunding our large urban area, which in the state of Wisconsin is primarily Milwaukee, that's where you are going to be hurting everybody within that school district. And you're definitely hurting students of color. I don't think that's acceptable. And I think if we would have adjusted for inflation of where we were funding on a per pupil basis 15 years ago, our pupils would be valued $3,000 more than they are right now. That combined with a focused attack from Republicans on Milwaukee, that adds up. Right. 18 of the last 20 years have been under Republican control in the legislature, and they have had this overarching focus to continue to cut public education, to shift dollars out of schools, public schools, to unaccountable voucher schools, and using any test result as an excuse to continue to cut or continue to make it harder for teachers. And I don't think I need to remind you, we had Act 10, which was specifically targeted at teachers and has led to a lot of people exiting the profession, a lot of people not going into it. One in three teachers, new teachers, leave the profession within 5 years because they cannot find their footing. They're not paid. They're not valued. And I think we need to address those things within a school. And as I mentioned, you have to address those things outside of a school. But this is on all of us. I think as we're having these conversations, I think if there are folks who are trying to find a scapegoat, they are trying to get the attention off of themselves. This is not something we would allow with your own kids in your own house, to allow them to fall behind and try to punish them into success. It wouldn't work. So why should we treat our neighbor's kids any different to make sure that we are wrapping our arms around them, giving them what they need, and having those high standards and then dedicating ourselves to making sure that they can hit them?
Meanwhile, Senator Larson, Superintendent Jill Enderle said in a statement the legislature has let public school funding fall behind. You have laid that out in what you've just said here, but she also connected these test results to under-resourced schools and is asking for the $4 billion in new spending in her two-year budget proposal. What level of state aid do you support, given what you see in this data?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's it. We have tried to wag our fingers, the state, at schools and to be able to say, do more with less, right? And throwing more hurdles at them, requiring them to have new requirements without funding those. As I'm sure you know, there's $50 million sitting in the state coffers that were assigned to deal with literacy specifically. Mm-hmm. Schools have had to do it, but the money has not been forwarded to them to actually tackle those problems. So the numbers, while it's stunning, $4 billion, right, to be able to meet the investment for our public schools, that's also the amount of money that we have in our state surplus. So this is the time to do it. There is no cheap way out of this. You have to make sure you are funding every kid so that they show that they're valued. We need to do that first and every single day by investing in our kids. I think investing in teachers in the classroom, so to a ratio that gives them the opportunity to connect with each child to show that they're valued. And I think, you know, I don't want to sound like somebody who's far away from it, but you know, Kate, picture your favorite teacher. Mm-hmm. That you might have had when you were in grade school. And if your listeners are thinking that same way, think of your favorite teacher, you know, and you think about it now, was their motivation the paycheck? And for most of them, it's the mission, it's the service to the kids and making a difference. We should not exploit that by paying teachers a starting wage of $34,000, which is less than a legislator gets. I introduced a bill to make sure every teacher in the state starting is making at least as much as a legislator. By valuing the teachers, they in turn can value the kids, and every kid then feels valued. And to paraphrase FDR, kids don't care what you know until they know that you care.
Just to put a finer point, would you put the bulk of the state's budget surplus into education?
Yes. Okay. Yes. I mean, there's a lot of things that we can and should be investing in, but there's nothing in my mind that's more important than making sure that our kids are caught up. We have had 15 years where we have fallen behind, where the cuts initially happened when there was, I mean, way, way back when there was the mortgage crisis of and the financial crisis mm-hmm. of 2008, 2009. We have not caught up to that point. So again, I mentioned it earlier, but if you adjust where we were then and adjust for inflation, every single child in our state should be getting $3,000 more worth of investment. And it's clear in these scores, this should be a rallying call for everybody to step up and say, we need to catch this up. And if we're not, we are mortgaging off our future, right? So yes, we might have a little bit of a tax cut, you know, for the very rich, they get a much bigger one. And in the meantime, we're paying for it by underfunding our kids.
Talking with Democratic State Senator Chris Larson, looking at results of the nation's report card. In terms of the Literacy Law Act 20, you mentioned that would change how kids are taught to read in Wisconsin. The $50 million needed to fund that law is yet to be released by the legislature's budget committee. What are next steps there in this session?
Yeah, I mean, there's the governor mentioned it in his State of the State last week. I imagine he's going to continue to try and put pressure on the Republicans in joint finance to release those dollars. I'm not sure what they are waiting for, but the budget was signed off on. That money should have been released to go into schools. And mind you, it wasn't enough to be able to fund the literacy programs as they were outlined in the law. But the money was specifically added to get Superintendent Enderle on board and to be able to get a lot of Democrats, including the governor, on board to say you have to actually fund this. So to have this, you know, Lucy and Charlie Brown situation where they decide to pull the money back after, you know, the bill was passed, it's unethical, and the person who's swinging and missing is our kids. Like, we're not investing in literacy because I'm not sure they just believe that the schools have enough or have enough resources, or they're just looking for ways to punish them. So that's it's irresponsible, and you'd have to ask them why they think it's a good idea that the $50 million is you know, better sitting in the state coffers than being spent on literacy for our kids.
Let's take one look here at special education cost reimbursement. State Superintendent Jill Enderle calling for those costs to be reimbursed eventually at 90%. You told WPR last fall that you support that rate. Would an increase in special education funding lead to improved test scores, help close the achievement gap between Black and white students?
Yes. Yes, undoubtedly. 90%. And if that sounds like a lot, I know that I've had some folks, including reporters, who are like, well, why is the state not funding 100%? And just to back up, what special education reimbursement means is there's a recognition by the state that students who have an IEP or individualized education program, some type of a disability or something that's holding them back just a little bit, they need a special education. They need a direct attention from educators and professionals. And so the state in the past has said that we are going to fund that so that you are held harmless. This is important because public schools have a higher percentage of students with disabilities than private schools, even those that take private vouchers. Now, private voucher schools get 90% of those costs reimbursed. Public schools get 34%. And it's not even a guarantee. They have to fight every other school district in the state for it. So the real number is actually going to end up probably being less than 30%. The other 60% has to come from somewhere, Kate. And it's usually in larger class sizes for everybody. It's usually in them having to cut entire programs to try and make up for this. Schools should not be penalized for trying to bring every student up to proficiency and making sure that no one is left behind. But right now, that's exactly what the state is doing.
State Senator Chris Larson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Have a great weekend, Kate.
Thank you. Chris Larson is the Wisconsin State Senator representing District 7 in Southeast Milwaukee County. We've been talking about the release of the 2024 National Assessment of Educational Progress, which provides data for the nation's report card and how Wisconsin 4th and 8th graders stack up. Wisconsin Today also reached out to two Republicans on the Assembly Education Committee, but didn't hear back. Coming up, ancient Native American mounds are rediscovered in Milwaukee's oldest operating cemetery. Find out about preservation efforts underway.
You know, talking to family members and talking to tribal leaders about how we can come to some agreement on the best way to interpret the site.
That's next on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Native Americans have lived in the area now called Wisconsin for over 12,000 years. And throughout this time, Native people built sacred burial mounds. According to the State Department of Natural Resources, Wisconsin has a large number of ancient burial and effigy mounds, but many have been destroyed or impacted by development. We'll talk with an archaeologist in Dodge County who is leading efforts to clean up mound sites by carefully removing invasive vegetation. But first, two mounds were recently rediscovered on the property of Milwaukee's oldest operating cemetery. The cemetery is currently working with tribal members on a plan to preserve and care for the mounds. Sarah Tomlin is executive director of the Forest Home Historic Preservation Association for the Forest Home Cemetery and Arboretum in Milwaukee. Sarah, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
These two mounds at Forest Home Cemetery, they are ancient. They have a long history in Wisconsin, but they are recently coming before our attention. How did you become aware of the mounds?
Well, we are a historic site, and we do tours. We have about 17 docents that do historical tours. And one of our docents wanted to be accurate about where the mounds were that Increase Lapham had mapped out. So we got in touch with Bill Quackenbush, tribal leader from the Ho-Chunk. And he came out and we said, this is the original 72 acres that Increase Lapham designed.
And Increase Lapham is the civil engineer pioneer.
Yes. I mean, he's Wisconsin's first naturalist. He wrote several books by the time he was 25. He did so many amazing things. But he also, probably like less important for him in his life, he designed the first 72 acres of the cemetery. And he also was a city surveyor at the time. And so he mapped out a lot of the indigenous mounds that were in the area before they were developed. We knew that there were two conical mounds that had resided on the original 72 acres from maps that he had designed. And so we brought out Bill Quackenbush to take a look at it to see if he could interpret whether those mounds still existed, or at least give us an idea of kind of where they were. He came out in February of 2023, and he basically said, here's a mound and here's a mound. And it was very quick that he was able to interpret that. And I went into the office at the cemetery where we have our individual site maps. We have over 50 sections in the cemetery, and these were in section 15 and 19. And those maps, the burials are in a round form. So it's our theory that these were actually designed by Increase Lapham in order to preserve the mounds.
Wow.
Because that is not a very efficient way to bury people.
Right, right. So how are you then working with tribal community members to create a plan to care for these mounds into the future?
Well, so far we have let the Wisconsin Repatriation, Tribal Repatriation Committee know about it. We've talked to the Wisconsin Historical Society. We've been working with the Native American professor and American history professor, Dr. Brian Reinflesch, and also Dr. Jennifer Haas, who works at UWM in the anthropology department. We have not done anything yet. We have not made any decisions at this point. What we're doing now is we're going to be reaching out to all the stakeholders, and we have sort of the framework for a cultural resource plan so that we are able to do this in the correct way. And at this point, nothing's happened.
What do you mean by stakeholders? Who are the stakeholders?
Stakeholders would be people who are tribal nations. Also, we have burials in those mounds. So we have family members who are also part of those mounds. So being able to have all of the groups have some input into the interpretation of the site.
Can you talk about more what you learned about these mounds and their formation?
Well, they're conical mounds, and I think the earliest conical mounds date back as far as 500 BC. They are mortuary mounds. I mean, they were for the purpose of burial, is my understanding. And they were part of a larger group, like about 50 other mounds in the area. And this area, the settlers called the Indian Fields. And so it was an area that was occupied by people who were Native American.
So, you know, as you go forward here, how does this impact the cemetery's capacity for burials or your placement of future burials? I mean, this is, you know, two sections you're talking about, but you have dozens of sections.
Well, I mean, this is in the areas that are the mounds. Mm-hmm. They are some of our earliest burials. So the sections had their first burials in 1854. The cemetery dates back to 1850. And the most recent burial that's occurred in those spaces is in the 1960s. So it's been quite a while since we've had any burials in those areas. I mean, we are a National Historic Site. We are tasked with, you know, remembering people and also making sure that burial areas are protected. So I feel like this is completely in our wheelhouse, and it's a very good place to have these mounds. And so we're going to be talking to family members and talking to tribal leaders about how we can come to some agreement on the best way to interpret the site. Because I know this is something that's been very challenging for lots of other mounds in the state, and doing it right and making it, whether it's signage or not, how we interpret it. We definitely, as a historic site and as a place that does tours, we do field trips too with children. So we look at this as an opportunity to have that educational component too.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure.
That is Sarah Tomlin, Executive Director of the Forest Home Historic Preservation Association for the Forest Home Cemetery and Arboretum in Milwaukee. Two mound discoveries there, raising new questions about preservation efforts. And now we're joined by Kurt Sampson, Director and Curator for the Dodge County Historical Society Museum. He's also an interpretive volunteer at the Effigy Mounds National Monument and founder of the Effigy Mounds Initiative. Kurt, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning, and thanks for having me.
Good morning. You have a long history in carrying out preservation work for burial and effigy mounds around the state. What does that involve?
Well, basically, it involves identifying sites out there that are not protected by the Burial Sites Protection Act fully, which was enacted back in 1985-86 by Governor Thompson. And what I do basically with our group is we go around the state and we work with private and public landowners that have mound sites on their property. We approach those landowners and we offer to help get those mounds properly cataloged with the Office of the State Archaeologist, with the State Historical Society, with Amy Rosebro, Dr. Rosebro. That way they're cataloged burial sites and they are afforded the full protection of the Burial Sites Protection Act. And what a lot of landowners don't realize in the state is that if you have a mound site on your property and you have an archaeologist like myself come and get that site cataloged, that you can get a tax reduction on that portion of your property taxes. So there is incentive for landowners to help preserve the remaining mounds that are in the state. And then the other half of what we do is we go and we assess the site for best care practices to care for that mound site. Oftentimes these mound sites are overgrown with invasive woody plant species like buckthorn and honeysuckle and garlic mustard and things like that. And so I organize work crews to go out and help take care for the site, to take that those woody invasives off the site, and especially off the top of the mounds, which can be detrimental to the mounds, and any large trees that might be on top of mounds. Eventually those trees get old and they will fall over and uproot the mounds, so we take the trees off the mounds as well.
Kurt, when mounds are located in, say, a cemetery or in a forest parkland situation, is that more helpful to be able to institute best care practices to preserve those mounds well into the future?
Well, sure. There are several cemeteries around the state of Wisconsin that actually contain ancient burial mounds. And by and large, most of these cemeteries around the state have recognized those mounds as such and are caring for them by keeping trees off of them, keeping the vegetation down on the top of them. And we actually have one in Dodge County that's just a couple miles down the road where we have two large panther effigy mounds in a cemetery. It's called the Highland Prairie Cemetery. And the county does a good job of taking care of those mounds. So in a lot of cases, the Effigy Mounds Initiative hasn't really done a lot of work with cemeteries just because those sites are pretty well maintained. Most of the time, though, there's non-interpretive signage on those sites that are indicating that these are mounds.
You recently received an award from the Wisconsin Historical Society for your work at Nitschke Mounds in Dodge County with the 46 documented effigy mounds there. Can you tell us about that project and your work there in preservation of this mounds group?
Sure. When I came to Dodge County as the director after finishing grad school at UW-Milwaukee, I was acutely aware that there were Dodge County had a very high concentration of mound sites that still existed, and I was very interested in documenting all of those mound sites, and Nitschke Mounds was one of them. It was right around the time that I came here, about 15, 16 years ago, that the Nitschke family had deeded the property over to the Dodge County Parks Department to turn it into a county park. And the Dodge County Parks Department didn't have any real firsthand experience caring for a mound site. And it was right around that time that I had formed the Effigy Mounds Initiative and decided to pick up the torch. So I contacted Bill Allenbeck, who's the director of the County Parks Department, and we worked out a management plan to care for the mounds in the park. And for really the last six winters, my volunteer crew and I have gone out there to basically work on the 14 mounds that are in the northern third section of the park that had not been cared for yet. And we basically worked from west to east to over five winters to clean out that site of all the invasives, all the trees off the mounds, provide a 5-foot buffer to each mound, and identify any native species of plants and trees that were kept. And one thing that we've learned over the last decade or so is that it's a better practice to keep the mature tree canopy on the site that's indigenous to the site, because that helps to keep the invasive species from overrunning a site. And there were part of sites at Lizard Mound State Park and at Nitschke that had been completely clear-cut with the hope that they would turn that back into Oak Savannah Prairie. Well, the problem with that is that if you don't have the resources to continuously work towards that goal, within a season, those sites can be completely overrun again, and then you're back to square one. So you have to have the resources to do it. And the way the Burial Sites Protection Act is written in Wisconsin is that you can't have any subsurface disturbance of the mound site proper. So what we do is we cut those stumps flush to the ground or flush to the mound surface, and then treat them, and then continue to monitor that on a seasonal basis.
Wow, that is a lot of work, and it's a lot of documentation as well. Why are invasive species, invasive plants, so bad for these ancient mounds?
Well, it's just one of those things where, you know, if you leave a forested area that has invasive species like buckthorn, I mean, they just completely take over the entire forested area. And their root system is so invasive that it's very difficult to eradicate some of these invasive woody species. And they do impact the integrity of the mounds if they're on top of the mounds with their root systems. And so, yeah, it's best to cut those things back into to keep the larger trees off the mounds, because, you know, like I said, eventually those trees mature and they die and then they fall. And I've been on many, many mound sites around the state where this is happening, where actual ancient burials have been exposed from trees tipping over. And another site we're working on is up in Chetek, Wisconsin, where they have a site that's called the Pleasant Plain Mound Group. That's a very ancient conical burial mound site that is very overgrown. And last Saturday, we had our first care day up there, where we had 15 volunteers from the Effigy Mounds Initiative show up to start to work on that site as well. And that site had a lot of mounds that were also pitted into by relic hunters in the distant past. So those mounds were compromised from an erosional standpoint. And so we're working to eventually try to shore up those issues as well.
We talked recently with Ho-Chunk Elder Richie Brown about his work surveying and marking mounds around the state. And let's listen to what he said about the importance of these mounds.
These sites have a lot of power, have a lot of energy. And that's why you have to be real careful and respectful of what you do there, too. But it's some amazing stuff, and that's what we're trying to do, is leave something for the younger generation.
Kurt, how do you go about doing this work respectfully as a non-tribal member?
Well, that's a good question. And what I've always done is reached out to the tribes, especially the Ho-Chunk. And I know Bill Quackenbush, the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer of the Ho-Chunk, very well, and several other Ho-Chunk members that I've consulted with over the years to, get their input about what they thought was appropriate and what wasn't appropriate to do on these mound sites. And I'll be honest with you, there have been some instances where I've been approached by Native American people that didn't think it was appropriate that people like me that are not Native American work on these mound sites. But from my experience with dealing with mounds for the better part of the last 30-plus years, it's been my experience that the more people are educated about the mounds, the better that they're protected. It's also my belief that these mounds are all part of our unique cultural heritage as a people in Wisconsin. And I firmly believe that it's all of our responsibilities to take care of these mounds. About 80 to 85% of the mounds that once existed have been destroyed. And there's only about 3,300 to 3,400 effigy mounds left. Mm. And that's not really a large number, even though it seems like a large number. And many of these sites are still threatened. And as you know, archaeological resources are a non-renewable resource. And once they're destroyed, they're gone forever. So I think it's part of our collective cultural heritage that all of us care for these sites at this point.
Kurt, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm glad to be here anytime, and thank you for having me.
That was Kurt Sampson, director and curator of the Dodge County Historical Society Museum and founder of the Effigy Mounds Initiative. We talked with him about efforts to preserve and care for indigenous burial mounds. And earlier, we heard from Sarah Tomlin, who leads the Historic Preservation Association for the Forest Home Cemetery and Arboretum in Milwaukee, and their plans to care for two mounds that were recently rediscovered in the cemetery. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, meet a Milwaukee chef who's up for a National James Beard Award and find out what brought him to Wisconsin and why he loves the food culture.
It was exciting to be part of a food scene that was having a renaissance.
That's coming up next here on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On President Donald Trump's first day in office, he suspended the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program. That left a number of Afghans who worked alongside the U.S. government and military for years in limbo. Back in 2022, hundreds of Afghan refugees in similar situations settled in Wisconsin through that program. On today's Wisconsin Life, host Maureen McCollum brings us a story of some of those Afghan refugees whose lives are at the center of an exhibit in Appleton.
After the Taliban returned to power in Afghanistan in 2021, thousands of people fled the country. In 2022, more than 850 of those Afghan refugees resettled in Wisconsin. Now, many of them are making their home in the state. WPR's Joe Schultz has more on an exhibit in the Fox Valley, trying to foster more understanding about the area's newest neighbors.
Farah walks through a pop-up oral history exhibit at the History Museum at the Castle in Appleton, looking at portraits of fellow Afghan refugees. Farah lives in the Fox Cities, and WPR is withholding her last name due to safety concerns for her family back in Afghanistan. The exhibit is called Our Afghan Neighbors. It features banners with photos of Afghan refugees who have settled in northeast Wisconsin. The portraits are accompanied by interview excerpts that help tell their stories. Farah conducted the interviews.
When I was doing the interview, I realized this much of diversity within Afghanistan. Like, every one of us are from one of the provinces. So I saw a lot of difference in our culture, too.
The exhibit was designed to move between different places like schools, universities, churches, and businesses. Farah says it's meant to help Wisconsinites better understand their Afghan neighbors.
These people who are coming, all of them hate war and violence. They just escaped from that. They just want peace. They value education. They want to improve their life here. They want to support their kids. They want their kids to be happy here.
But Farah admits that moving to Wisconsin wasn't exactly easy. She arrived with her husband and son in January 2022, and they had never experienced winter before.
I was crying. I told my husband, no, I don't want to stay here. It's so cold. I really cannot.
She and her husband both found jobs soon after and eventually chose to make the Badger State their home. Farah grew up in western Afghanistan in the Herat province, and she loved going to school.
I have very good memories of my parents supporting me, going to school, then university.
Farah began working for the Lincoln Learning Center in Afghanistan in 2014 as part of a United States-funded project.
I was teaching English language as a second language for university and school students. We were advising for the students who wanted to come to the United States to continue their education.
Farah says that program helped thousands of Afghans come to the U.S. for their master's or doctorate degrees before they returned to Afghanistan. Her husband also worked with the U.S. government as a university lecturer. As the number of U.S. troops in Afghanistan declined throughout 2020 and into 2021, the Taliban was seizing more and more land. Farah says Afghanistan's residents had experienced social reforms before the Taliban returned to power that gave women more freedom to get an education in advance. She says that all went away when the Taliban returned to power in the summer of 2021.
Everything changed, and women didn't want to stay in that country and experience the same things that they have had like 20 years ago. That was the reason everyone just wanted to get out of Afghanistan and don't see that those scary scenes from their childhood.
She and her husband left Afghanistan in 2021. Their work with the U.S. government helped them secure visas to leave. When she settled in Wisconsin, Farah remembers having some challenges feeling at home, like struggling to find traditional halal foods. She says World Relief Wisconsin helped provide rides to Oshkosh or Milwaukee to get the food she needed. And things have only improved since her first January in Appleton.
The cost of living is lower than this, some other states. So we are seeing other Afghans coming. We have an Afghan family who opened a store here. So we don't need to go to like Oshkosh or Milwaukee. So it's going well.
As Farah continues to establish her Wisconsin roots, she works for World Relief and helps other refugees resettle in Wisconsin. People who may one day share their own stories.
WPR's Joe Schultz brought us that story on the Our Afghan Neighbors exhibit in Appleton. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today. For the fourth year in a row, a Milwaukee chef has been nominated for a James Beard Award, a designation compared to the Oscars of the food world. Gregory Leon is a chef and the owner of Amalinda in Milwaukee. His restaurant opened in 2015 and has received recognition from local food magazines like Milwaukee Magazine and On Milwaukee, among others. And he was nominated for the James Beard Award for Outstanding Chef earlier this month. He was a finalist for Best Chef in the Midwest in 2022 and 2023 and a semifinalist for Outstanding Chef last year. Gregory Leon talked to Rob Ferret earlier this week.
Let's start with this nomination. Another one, fourth year in a row for a James Beard Award. I know probably the true satisfaction is happy customers. That said, what do these nominations mean for you?
First, I want to make sure everybody understands it's not just a reflection on me. It's a reflection on my staff. Also, I don't do everything here. I don't cook all the food. I don't take it to the tables. You know, it means that all the hard work that we're putting into this and all the things that we give up for this career and this lifestyle are worth it. It's nice to have people that you're in the same field with, that you look at, that you admire, think that you're doing a good job. You know, it also helps. I was talking to somebody yesterday. It helps with that little voice that I think most of us have in our head that likes to tell us that we're being an imposter. Mm. So, you know, there's a little bit of validation in there, too.
All right, I want to go back 10 years ago or so. You came to Milwaukee, I believe, from San Francisco as you, I don't know, had a map open or whatever. What made you decide it's going to be Milwaukee where I do my restaurant?
So in 2012, I was traveling and Milwaukee was not on my radar. I'd been in California for 18 years. It was super expensive. I knew I would never be able to open a restaurant without having a bunch of people involved, which kind of defeated the purpose in my eyes of opening a restaurant. And so I traveled that summer and I was going to move to Portland. And a friend of mine is from here. And he was just like, come visit. And I'm like, what is a Milwaukee? I've never been there. I don't know where it is. I looked it up in a map. I was like, oh, it's right by the water, which I'd love, but it looks like it's really cold. The main thing I wanted to do was find a city that had a food scene. It didn't have to be a big food scene, but it had a food scene where I, could open a restaurant and do the kind of food that we do here at Amelinda and, you know, make a couple coins and live off of that. And so my friend just like for 3 days in a row, just kept texting me, come visit. And I was like, I haven't worked in 6 months. I don't really have a lot of extra money. I'm traveling on vouchers for an airline that doesn't go to Milwaukee. It's like, it's just not in the cards. And 2 days later, he calls me. He says, I had a bunch of miles and I got you a ticket. He's like, I really think you need to come visit.
Wow.
So that was the beginning of them trying to convince me to stay here. And so after being here for a week, meeting a lot of different people, going to different restaurants, I figured this was a nice place to be.
And you're right. You're still here now in Wisconsin. What is it about the Milwaukee food scene that didn't just bring you here, but has had you staying here and being an important part now of that scene?
Well, first of all, the people in Milwaukee are super nice. Like, just people are so nice and friendly. So that I loved. I liked the fact that there's a sense of community amongst most of the chefs and restaurant owners. Not all of us like each other. We're humans. But I would say, 80% of us are really good friends. And we do stuff with each other and we help each other out. So I liked that a lot. I'd never experienced that. There was a great food scene. And it was, fairly young in a sense that, Odd Duck had just opened. You had places like Braise and La Merenda. There we go. Those restaurants had been open for a while, and they were kind of trailblazers, in my opinion, in the Milwaukee dining scene. But Milwaukee's always had a food history. There's brats and cheese and all that stuff. So the people just like drew me in. That's what it was. I discovered all these other things about the sense of community and all that once I started working on my restaurant. It was exciting to be part of a food scene that was having a renaissance, as if you would say.
Now, sometimes when we see kitchens on TV or in the movies or whatever, there's this sort of almost tyrannical thing. The head chef and everybody else bows and cringes and stuff like that. You've talked elsewhere about, A, not wanting to do that, and B, trying to help your staff grow as chefs and maybe go off and open their own restaurant themselves. Why is it important to you to help develop some of the talent of the future?
I worked for several chefs in San Francisco who were not the nicest. And, I started my cooking career in 1994. So no internet, no cell phones, and that gross behavior that we all associate with chefs was the norm. And I remember working for people and not being motivated by that behavior. So, ultimately what we want to do here at Amelinda is put out some really good food and have people leave happy. And I think in order to do that, you have to have a staff that's happy and wants to be there. I own the place and there's mornings when I wake up and I'm like, ugh, I don't want to go to work today. But that just has more to do with I want to be lazy. It's not like I don't want to be in the space with the people. And so I get it. Sometimes, the sous chef or, the bartender is going to wake up and be like, ugh, I don't want to go to work. But I never want it to be because they're like, that guy's a monster. I think it's great to look at these young cooks and see what they're doing. And they're very innovative and, their brains are full of ideas, sometimes too many ideas. And they're very ambitious, and that's great. The future of Milwaukee's dining scene is bright.
We're talking about the independent Milwaukee restaurant Amelinda with its owner and chef Gregory Leon, who was recently nominated for James Beard Award for the fourth year in a row. People are listening, Gregory, and they're thinking, Rob, you're talking to a chef. Where's the food? So you said you came in and wanted to do food inspired by Spanish and Portuguese cuisine. Why focus on that part of the world?
I had spent a lot of time in Spain, which I really like. I love the country. I love the relationship they have with food and cooking. To them, it's part of the day. It's not like, oh, I've got to do this. You know, it's like, okay, cool. Now it's time to cook and eat. It's an event into itself. So I love that part about Spain. And it's the same thing for Portugal. It reminded me a lot of growing up in Venezuela. And then I like that, you know, you eat their food, you put it in their mouth and you're like, oh, this is fairly complex and it's got different textures and different flavors. But when you're putting it together, actually the preparation of it is not extremely complicated. So they're very minimalist, I think, when it comes to cooking. And you want to start with like some really great ingredients and just let them do the work. Sometimes I like to say that we're merely translators for the ingredients, and we're helping them communicate their flavor and texture and color to the customer.
Well, it seems like Spain and Portugal have had a lot of contact with a lot of the world.
Yeah.
Does that leave you like with a, I guess, really wide palette to choose from?
It does. You know, we really try to stay true to Spanish and Portuguese flavors, but then sometimes, you know, we'll look at the Caribbean. A lot of it, you know, has Spain's imprint on it, and it was colonized by Spain. You know, Portugal had a colony in India, so, you know, sometimes we'll use the curry powders from that region in some dishes. You know, same thing with Macau, also used to be a colony of Portugal. So, you know, sometimes we'll do stuff where we're using fish sauce and coconut milk. So it does give us a wide array of ingredients, but we try to stay mostly within the Iberian Peninsula.
You change, correct me if I'm wrong, you change the menu weekly there. Is that right?
Yes, we do. So our menu is, I think, 12 items usually is the minimum amount. 4 to 5 starters, and then 5 to 6 entrees, sorry. And so, you know, again, going back to when I was a line cook for somebody, your menus, you're working at a restaurant where the menu stays the same for like maybe 3 to 6 months at a time, and you just kind of became a robot because you're doing the same thing day in and day out, day in and day out. And so, again, not something that would motivate me. I would still, you know, you still do it because it's your job, but you're just kind of on autopilot. And I think that's when mistakes start to happen. People start to get sloppy. They don't care. You know, sometimes it's a whole new dish. And sometimes it's a matter of like, well, I really like this kind of beef and I like the sauce, but let's change up the vegetable or the starch that it's going with. And I think, you know, it keeps everybody interested. When we first opened, though, it was funny because the customers would get really mad. They would come out like, I was in here 2 months ago and I had XYZ and I want that again. And I'm like, well, we don't have XYZ, but we've got ABC. Now, after 10 years, that's what they've come to expect. And it keeps us all like engaged. It keeps our brains focused. You know, we're constantly reading and doing research and eating out. So I think it's good. It's good on many levels.
Looking to the future of Amelinda, what are your goals? What does success look like for you over the next few years?
You know, I've never wanted to own a restaurant empire. Every once in a while, I'd be like, oh, it might be kind of fun to go through the process of opening another one. And then I come into the restaurant and it's day gross and I'm running around like crazy. And I'm like, I don't even know how I would do that. You know, so I my success would be us open, celebrating our 20th anniversary and have inspired a lot of young cooks to move on from Amelinda and open their own place. And hopefully they've picked up some good habits and some good techniques and they can be equally as successful as we are.
Gregory, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That was Gregory Leone, a chef and owner and operator of Amelinda. That's a restaurant in Milwaukee serving food inspired by Spanish and Portuguese flavors. Recently named a semifinalist for a James Beard Award for Outstanding Chef, his 4th James Beard nomination in a row. Finalists are scheduled to be announced in early April. We've been hearing about the passion and the drive of a Milwaukee chef honored with a James Beard nomination. And we want to know if there's a chef or a restaurant owner in your area who has a special connection to the community, a special story. Share what that story is. What is the food like? What brings you back to their restaurant again and again? If you could give out a James Beard Award, who would it go to? Share your story about culinary excellence in your life, in your community, the special bond you have with a local restaurant. Email wisconsintoday at WPR.org. That's wisconsintoday at WPR.org. You can also reach us at 888 888- 642-0232. Drop us a line. You can also send us a text. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.